from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, President Obama announced a proposal to create the world's largest ocean sanctuary. It would put a huge swath of the Central Pacific off limits to fishing and energy exploration. But in an era of warming climate, acidifying oceans, and the Pacific's infamous trash vortex, what does and doesn't a marine sanctuary protect? What do our oceans need? This hour on Point, big new marine sanctuaries and the fate of the seas. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you know this part of the world, this part of the Pacific? Would you put it off limits? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Washington is Juliette Alperin, White House reporter for The Washington Post and a longtime environmental reporter. She also wrote about the establishment of marine sanctuaries in her recent book on sharks, Demon Fish, Travels Through the Hidden World of Sharks. Juliette, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
What is the president proposing?
He is proposing expanding a national marine monument that was actually established by George W. Bush back in 2009 in the middle of the South Central Pacific. It's a series of seven islands and atolls. And so rather than one contiguous monument, it's this idea of expanding what is already a 50-mile ring around each of these islands and atolls and bringing it out 200 miles from shore to make sure that even more of this part of the world is protected from any sort of extractive activities.
That would push the size of this sanctuary or monument up very dramatically from just about 87,000 square miles to 782,000 square miles. How big a piece of the Pacific is that, Juliette?
That's a good question. I don't know exactly what portion of the Pacific it is, but it would replace right now the largest marine, fully protected marine reserve in the world is also in the Pacific in around the Chagos Islands, which is British territory. And this would double the amount of ocean in the world that is fully protected. Right now, we protect less than 1% in fully from all sorts of activities.
I'm looking at a map of this, of the Pacific here, and it is a pretty substantial thing. If you think of a, I don't know, a human torso, this looks as big as the stomach in there. Or something like that. This is south and west mainly of Hawaii, sort of north and east a bit of Samoa. We could do it because, what, as the consequence of history and war, the United States has claim to lots of little pieces of land that when you put all their 200-mile radiuses together, create a pretty big amoeba in the middle of the Pacific.
Right. And interestingly, the United States controls more of the sea this way than anyone else, roughly 13% of the ocean. And that's because any nation on Earth controls what's called an exclusive economic zone 200 miles out from any terrestrial territory that's under their control.
I mean, these are points of U.S. territory that most Americans have probably never heard of. Jarvis Island and Kingman Reef and Palmyra Atoll and Howland. Right. And I mean, these are really Wake. People know that. Johnston Atoll, close to Hawaii, maybe. Wake from war history. What would be prohibited in this very large space in the center of the Pacific Ocean?
So that's something that's going to be under discussion in the next few months, because at this point, the administration is going to be taking public comment. So right now, under what George W. Bush did, really the kind of only activity that is technically, theoretically allowed is sport fishing in the area that's been protected, not commercial fishing. Now, there is commercial fishing, again, from 50 miles to 200 miles out from these uninhabited islands. That's the main activity that the administration would be blocking should President Obama use his executive authority under a nearly century-old law to put it off limits. But in the future, it means that, as, for example, deep sea mining is awakening more interest in investors, that would be off limits. Oil drilling, things like that would all be prohibited.
Here's the president on Tuesday. This was at a video message to a State Department conference, called Our Ocean Conference, that the U.S. State Department put together, international attendees. Here the president of the United States laying out the rationale for much larger Pacific sanctuaries.
Rising levels of carbon dioxide are causing our oceans to acidify. Pollution endangers marine life. Overfishing threatens whole species, as well as the people who depend on them for food and their livelihoods. If we ignore these problems, if we drain our oceans of their resources, we won't just be squandering one of humanity's greatest treasures. We'll be cutting off one of the world's major sources of food and economic growth, including for the United States. And we cannot afford to let that happen.
We cannot afford to let that happen. A lot of questions, Juliet. First of all, can he just do that? George W. Bush did it. Can the president just push it on out to 200 miles on his own authority, restrict what he likes? Is it obvious that this will happen if he says it's going to happen?
Yes, he can. Under the 1906 Antiquities Act, which Teddy Roosevelt pushed for, any president can declare parts of federal land or federal waters off limits. And what we've seen is President Obama has actually used this power less frequently than many of his predecessors, including some Republican predecessors. He's done this 11 times on land, but not in the ocean. And so while he's certainly gotten a lot of attention for using his executive power in other ways, this is actually a fairly traditional way of using his authority to accomplish his objectives.
This is a big chunk of the sea, of the Pacific Ocean. What nationalities do most of the fishing in this area now?
It's actually only U.S. tuna vessels, for example, can operate in these waters. And right now it accounts for, depending on the estimates, if you look at what the Pew Charitable Trust has done, it's somewhere between 1-3% of the U.S. tuna catch in the Western and Central Pacific are caught in the area that right now is open to fishing.
So how much difference does this really make? It would protect only tuna. Everything else is already protected, you're saying. You're suggesting that
right.
We don't have Japanese trawlers going through there or anybody else is sort of doing the kind of deep sea, dragging the bottom, all that damage. That's
right.
Not going on there already?
Well, again, some of that is going on there. You know, again, there are activities
tuna
by
fishermen
some US,
don't do that.
By tuna fishermen. And while it's less an issue of trawling, they put out hooks mm-hmm. or they do purse seine. But fishing, those are kind of the two primary ways they're operating. There still is a significant bycatch, the accidental catch of, for example, large predatory fish, including sharks, which I've written a lot about, mm-hmm. or other fish, are still caught as a result of those fishing practices. So that's one factor. There's also what actually makes this area special in many ways is the underwater mountains that are there. Seamounts are what they're called. Mm-hmm. They're hotspots of biodiversity in the sea. And so one of the things that this would protect is it would quintuple the amount of these underwater mountains that are protected because you will not have vessels operating there. So that has ripple effects whether you're talking about not just the sea, the creatures in the sea, but also the millions of seabirds that congregate and nest on these uninhabited islands.
I've read ocean experts calling this some of the most pristine ocean on the planet. In terms of volume, in terms of space, how significant is it? I mean, I've also read that you put all the global ocean sanctuaries together and it's maybe less than 2% of the world's seas fully
right.
protected.
Right. So that's true. So the reason why it's actually in many ways so important is because in the words of many the scientists who have gone out there, it really looks like what the sea used to look like. And so it provides a baseline for scientists and policymakers when they're looking at what we should be doing to recover other parts of the sea that have been fished. For example, one thing that's fascinating is we always kind of think of animal life as an inverted pyramid where you have a small number of big predators like lions on the African savanna.
Mm-hmm.
Here, you actually, the large predators, again, those sharks, those other big fish, their biomass outnumbers the smaller fish. That actually totally defied what scientists' expectations were.
That's because it's such deep sea? Is that the reason? Is it so deep?
Well, that the big fish have not mm-hmm. been fished out.
Oh, I see.
Most studies show that roughly 90% of the large fish in the ocean have been fished out by humans. And so because that hasn't happened here, the ecosystem operates differently. And so it provides, again, it's a very remote place. It takes 10 days to get there by boat. But for researchers, it's actually extremely important. And so that's one of the reasons why it might be even more important than just the idea of what percentage of the ocean are you putting off limits.
And then the question of as big as it is, mm-hmm. and if it's adequately protected, and they're also looking at somehow protecting fish that have taken, what they want to keep track of. What's fished where so people can't sneak in and take the fish and sell them anyway, right? There's some measure like that, Julia.
Right. There's along in this conference you mentioned, the State Department Our Ocean Conference, one of the other initiatives that's now under consideration just broadly is having better traceability about where fish are coming from and moving, tracking vessels more accurately. So that's just a way to provide accountability in lots of ways, both for these protected areas, but frankly also for the areas that are most actively fished where, you know, that's going to be brought to whether it's Boston or other cities, mm-hmm. and people want to know what's on their plate.
Laying out these boundary lines, though, won't stop the warming of the seas. It won't stop acidification. I mean, the fish can swim in, the fish can swim out and be fished. It won't. I even wonder about the trash vortex we hear so much about in the Pacific. The big maps I see of all that plastic and junk floating around looks like it floats right through these so-called pristine seas.
Sure. Some of it does. Many scientists have found that the areas in the ocean that are just healthier are more resistant to climate change. It, of course, depends on an individual coral reef and so forth. But part of the argument that many researchers have made is that if you have some areas that are in better shape, just like a healthier patient, if they catch an illness, it's more likely to recover than someone whose immune system is already compromised. They feel that protecting some places will make them more resilient in the face of ocean acidification, warmer seas, and rising sea levels.
We've got a few months of comment period, but it sounds as though, Juliet, you're saying this is on. This is happening. This is essentially a done deal.
It is. I think it's going to be subject to some negotiation. You'll have recreational and commercial fishermen expressing some concerns, so it could change a bit, but this is something that the president has said he intends to do.
Biggest sanctuary anywhere ever in history. Juliet Oppen with Washington Post, author of Demon Fish. It's always great to talk with you, Juliet. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Obama's push for the biggest ocean sanctuaries in history and what they would mean. Conference put together by the U.S. State Department this week had a lot of people talking about what we're doing with our seas. The president made his announcement by video there. Secretary of State John Kerry was there, stressed the importance of protecting the world's oceans.
The bottom line is that most people don't realize that if the entire world doesn't come together to try to change course and protect the ocean from unsustainable fishing practices, unprecedented pollution, or the devastating effects of climate change, then we run the risk of fundamentally breaking entire ecosystems.
Secretary of State John Kerry there calling for the whole world to come together. That's still an issue, but this is a U.S. move, a presidential move on a very grand scale. Very happy to have with us right now a couple of people who know the seas extremely well. Sylvia Earle is with us from Oakland, California, marine biologist, ocean explorer, National Geographic explorer in residence, founder of Mission Blue. It's an organization devoted to creating a global network of marine protected areas, one of the most admired marine biologists on the planet. Sylvia Earle, welcome back to On Point. Wonderful to have you with us again.
Great to be on board.
And with us from Santa Barbara, California, Benjamin Halpern, professor at UC Santa Barbara School of Environmental Science and Management, research biologist at the university's Marine Science Institute, and director of the Center for Marine Assessment and Planning there. Benjamin Halpern, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
Sylvia Earle, first to you, how significant is this designation of these enormous sanctuaries?
It's a giant step in the right direction. We really do need to take care of the ocean. We have taken for granted what the ocean delivers to us, and I'm not talking so much about pounds of animals that we eat, but the ocean keeps all of us alive, generating most of the oxygen that is in the atmosphere, shaping climate and weather, regulating temperature, stabilizing the way the world works. Anything that we can do, anywhere that we can do it, is a move in the right direction.
Benjamin Halpern, can you describe this very large portion of the Pacific to us? Could you characterize it for those who haven't sailed across it or dived into it? What's it look like? What is it? What's unique about it?
Well, it is an incredibly vast area, and the islands and atolls that are part of this monument are rarely visited by many people, which is why they're in such amazingly good shape. So the reefs there are stunning. I mean, it's coral reefs like most people can't imagine, except maybe in the most beautiful pictures they ever see. And there's large fish and small fish and medium-sized fish, and everything you can really kind of picture in a coral reef system is alive and thriving there. And I think that's why people, scientists care so much about it, and why I think President Obama recognizes the importance of these areas.
Sylvia, it's so large that maybe it has some of everything, but we're hearing deep sea, we're hearing undersea mountains, but then we're also hearing atolls and reefs. That means deep and shallow. Does this contain everything? Is this mainly deep, Sylvia?
Certainly, it does include deep water in systems and creatures who live there. Is it enough? All by itself? No, it wouldn't be enough. But it's important to have places that are in good condition to serve as sources of restoration for places that have been depleted. We have, over the last 50 years, during my lifetime since I began exploring the ocean, seen remarkable changes in the nature of the ocean. I mean, huge declines in sharks and most of the creatures that we consume. But it's more than that. The ocean, the chemistry of the ocean is changing. And one of the concerns that really turned out to be a focus of the conference in Washington was acidification of the ocean. The ocean becoming literally more acid owing to carbon dioxide that is not only entering the atmosphere, driving global warming, it's also entering the ocean where CO2 becomes carbonic acid. That not only affects corals, it affects everything in a way, the chemistry of the ocean and the chemistry of life. So having places that are in good condition are more resilient to other changes, whether it's in terms of the plastic pollution that is now also engulfing the ocean, or the changes in the seawater itself, the acidification. It just helps to have places that are healthy, resilient, able to more appropriately, more able to contend with the changes that are taking place.
Benjamin Halpern, help us understand that. I mean, we've all gotten accustomed to the notion that the planet is a holistic kind of system, on the largest terms possible. When you start talking about ocean chemistry, as remote as this is in the Central Pacific, it's still very large. It's attached to every other part of every sea, every ocean in the world. Is the chemistry any different here? Is the acidification any different? Why would coral reefs be healthier here? Don't the chemicals diffuse everywhere, or is this somehow virginal?
Well, you're right. It is all connected. I mean, one of the points that John Kerry made at the conference is that it's one ocean on our planet. It's all connected, and it's all connected to the atmosphere as well. So what we do on land makes its way to pretty much every part of the ocean through the changing climate. So over time, these places in the remote Central Pacific will be feeling greater and greater pressures from climate change, from warming seas, as well as ocean acidification. But as Sylvia just said, having places that are more pristine, more intact, makes them more resilient to these kinds of pressures. So putting them aside, protecting them from fishing and other extractive activities is a big step forward in helping them be resilient in the face of these upcoming and ongoing changes to ocean chemistry, but it's not going to be enough in the long run. In order to really protect these places for generations moving forward, we need to be tackling some of these other big issues like climate change or the actions taken now in the long run won't have the intended effect that we all want for them.
Benjamin Halpern in Santa Barbara and Sylvia Earle in Oakland, California. Please stand by. Let me begin to go to our listeners. Brian in Montreal, Canada. Hi, Brian. Thank you for calling. You're on the air.
I'm glad to be here, and I'm very glad to hear Benjamin and Sylvia give this clear explanation of what's at stake. But excuse me as an amateur and an informed member of the public to say that it is largely of academic interest, and that's not a put-down. It is possible to look at pristine conditions there simply because these are the places that are the farthest from the influences that are making disastrous situations occur on the perimeters of our ocean basins. There are atolls there, but the reason there are atolls is because there are the very little bit of land that can, or coral activity that can put a foundation down on sea mountains, which are volcanic spikes out of the very deepest parts of the ocean crust. there is essentially very little biological activity, which is the only environment coral can survive in. It depends on extremely clear water so that its symbiotic biology can respond to very large levels of pure, clear sunlight. As a Canadian who has worked in a Canadian aquarium, and we have the largest coastline in the world, the real issues of the places where the real issues of preservation and conservation arise are on the perimeters of the continents. And this reserve is about as far as you get from those issues, places where the biggest issues and the most emergency issues are arising.
Brian, I appreciate your call. Let me take it to my guest, Benjamin. How about the argument that this is a kind of a gigantic dodge, that the real issues are near shore, this is far out at sea, it's got relatively little biological activity compared to elsewhere, looks grand, real impact, not what we need?
Well, it's an excellent point. There is a real challenge facing us in dealing with places that are actually heavily populated by people, and I think the biggest moves and challenges facing us are to deal with these conservation issues in continental shelf areas along the shores where people live, and so we do need to be moving in that direction. But I still think, as Juliet and Sylvia have also said, that setting aside places that are a reference point for scientists to understand, that bring inspiration to people for the existence value, that we know that these pristine places exist even if we never go to them. These cultural values of our planet are really important to people, and I think that can't be undervalued in when we talk about this. But there are real challenges facing us in managing our oceans and coastal areas, and I hope that this new move by Secretary Kerry and President Obama to focus on the oceans in a really concerted way will bring more and more attention towards these coastal areas. In fact, just a quick point, President Obama set up a national ocean policy a few years ago to start to tackle these exact kinds of issues, like how do we better manage our coastal oceans? So I think the administration is paying attention to that, and I hope other nations kind of jump on board and start thinking about how do we deal with the real challenges of these coastal oceans.
Sylvia, how about it? Inspiring, perhaps? Yes, big sanctuaries, but is this mainly theater when you put it in context of the full challenge to our ocean life?
Well, we do need a comprehensive plan. Half of the world, the high seas, are beyond the coastal areas, beyond national jurisdiction. They're the blue heart of the planet, and that area, too, is currently being looked at by the United Nations, by the Global Ocean Commission that reports out next week, that we have to think in a comprehensive way, but we certainly must have what some are calling refuge areas, places that are really in good shape and keep them that way while there's still time to embrace them with care. Coral reefs are not small in diversity. They are very large in terms of the range of life that is embodied there. Some call them the rainforests of the sea, with a high concentration of the diverse kinds of life on Earth, not just fish, not just corals, but the full range of the categories of life on Earth. We know how to kill whatever it is that we target, but the real key now is how do we look at the ocean as our life support system and think of taking care of it with overarching policies. I look at places in coastal areas as well as in remote places from where humans are as hope spots, places that if we do embrace them, that we can restore these damaged areas to better condition than they otherwise would be. I mean, Chesapeake Bay is not in great shape, but it's cause for hope because with care, with policies that are aimed at restoring health, it too can be part of this comprehensive way of looking at the ocean with new eyes. And that's part of what this new initiative is causing some of us to do, or maybe the whole world to do, look at the ocean with new eyes.
Sylvia Benjamin, let me turn to another caller here. Margaret in Tiverton, Rhode Island. Margaret, thank you for calling. You're on the air. What do you think?
Thank you. Hi, Tom. I think this is a wonderful idea, but what I haven't seen addressed is that the United States doesn't own all these waters, and I can't see how President Obama can announce unilaterally that he's doing this. What if other countries want to fish or mine in these waters? What happens?
But under the accepted law, this 200-mile economic zone does extend through this vast area. It's hard to... I know it's hard to picture, but I'm looking at the map, and these little atolls and reefs, when you draw the 200-mile radius around each of them, it turns into quite a large cloud.
Yes. Okay.
But nevertheless, it does raise the question, Margaret, thank you. Benjamin, Sylvia, it raises the question of whether the U.S. will really enforce this. I mean, you know, here we've got lots of people online asking about this. Meg says, well, if China starts fishing, does this mean the U.S. will defend its monument? And she says, serious question. Lejeune says, I'm overall in favor of this, but I'm amazed the United States can be confident it will be able to exercise authority over such a wide area. Scott says, I love the idea. Alas, I'm skeptical that the monument zones will be able to be protected as global population pressures increase for fisheries. How about it, Benjamin? Can we set this off? Will we put out the resources to defend it? How do you do that? Do you have to have satellites watching it all the time to make sure nobody's fishing there? And what about as, I mean, the global population's growing, the appetite for protein is growing, what about as demand for what's in there grows?
It's a great point, and of course any place that's so remote makes it hard to do surveillance and monitoring of it. But that was another of the major themes of the conference, and one of the announcements that President Obama made at the conference is to start improving our ability to track and enforce illegal fishing that happens, pirate fishing that happens around the world. So there's already substantial efforts in place to limit it, because it is a major problem. Some estimate that something like 20% of all fisheries are done illegally, and there's obviously lots of reasons we want to fix that, both economic as well as environmental reasons. And so with the new initiatives there'll be that Obama is pursuing, which is globally, a lot of countries are signing on to it, is to try to improve our tracking and managing of illegal fishing. So I think, you know, there are satellite technologies, there's drone technologies, ship-based technologies that all help to monitor and do surveillance on these areas. It's challenging. It's a big area. It's very remote. But there's huge incentive for governments to enforce these rules because, you know, we essentially own those waters, and we want to make sure that they're kept in as good shape as possible and that the resources in there are managed as sustainably as possible.
But, so but what do we see from actual experience? I mean, I'm reading a lot of commentary saying it's easy to say, here's a sanctuary, there's a sanctuary at sea, out of sight, out of mind, you don't enforce it, and fishing boats just run all over it, and no one even knows. That if lots of steps aren't taken to make it truly a sanctuary, it's kind of a farce.
Could I weigh in?
Yes, please. Sylvia Earle.
As people begin to understand how important the ocean is, not just for what we can take out of it, but or for what we can put into it, but that the ocean keeps us alive. There is, public pressure to take care of the ocean. We once thought the ocean was simply too big to fail, and policies that were put in place in the 50s and 60s and 70s were really aimed at using the ocean both for what we could extract and also as a place where we could put things that we didn't want close to where most people live. But that's changing, and so is the ocean. But we have learned more about the ocean in the last half century than during all preceding history, and now we know how important the ocean is to every breath we take, every drop of water we drink, and people are beginning to understand we must take care of the ocean.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about President Obama's push for the biggest ocean sanctuary in history
and what it would mean for marine life. Sylvia Earle is with us, marine biologist and ocean explorer, National Geographic Explorer in Residence, joins us from Oakland, California. Benjamin Halpern is here, expert on marine ecology and the effects of different conservation strategies, joins us from UC Santa Barbara. He's there at the School of Environmental Science and Management. Leonardo DiCaprio, big in putting lots of money into foundations who are working on the seas. He talked at the State Department Our Ocean Conference on Tuesday about the stakes involved in keeping our oceans healthy.
And while we've heard a lot about the impacts of climate change on dry land, the oceans will be the sink that absorbs the brunt of our pollution and the danger of higher temperatures. This is especially troubling since oceans are the source of most of our oxygen and life-giving nutrients on this planet. They dictate our climate, our weather patterns, and ultimately our own survival. Without healthy oceans, we are in serious trouble, and the outlook for their health is not good.
Leonardo DiCaprio there making the plea for global concern for oceans. Big sanctuaries on their way right here in U.S. waters in the center of the Pacific. Douglas in Newburyport, Massachusetts. Douglas, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I think this is a critical discussion that the whole world, I mean, regardless of who you are, should be like concerning himself. I don't think the sanctuary is actually big enough. If the ocean in itself, that everybody considered it a sanctuary and didn't deposit after they took, I mean, the garbage. And we as a people are just wasteful. And if we stop what our normal practices are, Sylvia's work would be so much easier. I mean, it's tracking goes. But what we've done is we've basically obliterated it, and the ocean is actually our lifeboat. And it's our final salvation if we don't stop what we're doing normally. And I think corporations, not just countries, should be held accountable or should want to participate willingly, not just ocean-based corporations, land bases as well, anybody in general.
Douglas, we've got it. Let me put it to Benjamin Halpern. Benjamin, take this, big as it is, and if you would, put it up against what, I mean, Sylvia Earle has described the insults to our oceans that have already occurred, the hope for something better here. If we really wanted to say, wait, stop, we want to fix the seas to it's hard to take them back to fully pristine, it may be impossible, but to something acceptable, something that keeps the lungs of the planet, the ocean, acceptably healthy and alive, what would a full-on project to do that look like, Benjamin?
Yeah, it would take a lot. And I think, you know, the point that the caller just made and that the many of the speakers, including Senator Kerry or Secretary Kerry and President Obama, made at the conference is that, you know, the health of humanity depends on the health of the ocean. And that's a really important point to keep in mind, that we depend on the oceans for so many things. We value them for so many things. And so we need a healthy ocean, not locked up in pristine conditions across the whole planet, because then we're not benefiting from it, but a healthy ocean that allows us to sustainably interact with and use the oceans to the, you know, the benefit of us, but also to the benefit of nature that's in the ocean. So a plan that comprehensively addresses that almost certainly includes a lot more large and smaller, you know, sanctuaries like the one that has been put into place. So this is just a first step in that direction. But it includes reforming fisheries management around the world, including stopping pirate fishing, which is another initiative. It includes thinking about how do you allow new uses like offshore wind energy, which is a key part of clean energy initiatives, to move forward without damaging the seas and in developing these installations. So thinking comprehensively about how you integrate all of these existing and emerging uses of the oceans in a way that helps humanity continue to thrive while also allowing the oceans to thrive is a big task, but it's something that the administration seems committed to, and a lot of countries around the world are trying to work towards. So for me, what's particularly great about what's happening this week is not so much these specific actions, which are great, but that the focus of our administration and other administrations around the world on ocean issues. It's just it's dire time that we focus on the oceans, and it's great to see that that's happening.
Sylvia Earle, can we have the planetary population that we have and that we're continuing to grow into greater size, whatever it's headed toward now, 9 billion, can we have that and have healthy seas?
Well, it's not an option. If we are to survive, we must take care of the systems that yield the things that life requires, our lives very much included. At this conference, not only did the United States have leadership in terms of addressing the importance of taking care of the ocean, but amazing, the president of the little island nation of Palau, Thomas Romingosau, announced the establishment of the entire exclusive economic zone of that small country to be off limits to commercial fishing. And that is, he wasn't against fishing, but the majority of that entire area the size of Texas that surrounds the little island nation of Palau, that they would, he would look at it, and his people would look at it as a total management area with much of it kept in pristine conditions, as pristine as is possible in today's world, and to really look at the local fishing as a priority, but to say that live fish are more valuable to his people and to his country than dead fish, that a fish, a shark alive, for example, had a much greater value than one that was taken and used once for its fins or meat or whatever. And he extended that to tuna, to all of the fish that are there, parrotfish that are important to the integrity of coral reefs. He looked at tourism, the primary driver of his nation's economy, and globally, it's a very big economic factor that exceeds the value of taking fish out of the ocean as an economic driver, that it's more important to protect the integrity of these systems just on economic grounds. But beyond that, he said, and others are acknowledging, and I certainly see this too, the ecological benefits of maintaining the living ocean that keeps all of the world in better shape, generating oxygen, driving the chemistry of the planet, the nitrogen cycle, the carbon cycle, things that until now people generally hadn't been tuned into or we had thought about. Scientists over the last 50 years have begun to gather information that puts in perspective why the ocean matters to all of us. It doesn't matter where on Earth you live, the ocean touches you, even if you've never touched the ocean. You breathe, so you should care. And I think what's really encouraging is the leadership role of this country, the United States. It sends a signal to the rest of the world and to, whether it's an island country in the far Pacific, such as Palau or Kiribati or the Indian Ocean or anywhere, that this nation is stepping up to the plate, that we are looking at the value of the ocean for reasons that transcend what we can take out or what we can put in. And people will continue to fish. We will, one way or the other, continue to allow our our trash or whatever flow into the sea. But now that we know, we can care individually and collectively and take actions that will lead to the possibility that whether we have 7 billion people or whatever the future may bring, we'll give ourselves an insurance policy, a better chance of being able to cope with the future.
Maybe. People trying to assess exactly what this sanctuary means in those terms. Bill in Liberty, Kentucky. Bill, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Well, thanks, Tom. And first of all, let me quickly say hi to Sylvia Earle. She helped me a great deal when I was special agent in Hawaii setting up the sanctuary for humpback whales. And that was the South Pacific area that you're talking about was my first area of responsibility right after the Magnuson Act went into effect, where we were claiming, 200 miles around all of the trust territories and commonwealths.
And Sylvia helped you protect the humpback whales. You were out there together. That's terrific, Bill. What do you think of the new sanctuary?
Well, I think it's going to work. We need to protect our oceans, and I think basically it's going to be terribly difficult to enforce. That is a long way from Hawaii, where the nearest Coast Guard station is, and we flew down there, did aerial surveillance, and I was involved in a seizure of a Japanese trawler on one of the seamounts, taking the pelagic armor head but it's very difficult to catch anybody in there just because it's so far away and it makes it so difficult to patrol.
Bill, you know this very well. People talk about paper parks. You know, you declare a sanctuary or a park, but it's just on paper and it's not actually happening at sea. Do we have the resources out of Hawaii or the U.S. territories to do it, Bill?
It's going to be very difficult down in the area they're talking about now. I was also part of the sanctuary there in Key Largo, and of course now we have a team of sanctuary officers, and that is very well protected. But I don't see that because of the large geographical area they're talking about in the South Pacific. It's going to be terribly difficult to patrol that. They're going to have to. Congress is going to have to come up with a lot of money for equipment and manpower if they're, really intending to patrol it and to enforce those laws.
Bill, I really appreciate your first-hand knowledge and your call. Sylvia, there's a hat tip to you from somebody who you worked with, apparently, out of Hawaii.
Oh, yes. Well, thank you for that. And I'm mindful that early in the 20th century, when President Theodore Roosevelt initiated moves to protect large areas of the western part of the country on the land, he had some of the same problems of how are you going to protect it and what difference does it make? They're way out west where nobody lives. I mean, we are in a new era where we do have access to technologies, and imagine if Theodore Roosevelt tried to do actions today, or his equivalent in Western United States. We have a chance in the Western Pacific before vested interests become so established that moves such as have been taken now to protect these waters while there's still time. That, you know, one thing that I find impressive is that this is not just the current administration looking at why the ocean matters and taking actions. It was actually President George W. Bush who initiated the protection of those atoll areas in the Western Pacific and the area around northwestern Hawaiian Islands. At the time, the largest marine protected areas, especially no-take areas, on the planet. And now a new administration, different party, but recognizing similarly this is about protecting the interests of the nation now and in the future, and for protecting the interests of humanity now and into the future.
Benjamin Halpern, to Bill's point, this is big. It's hard to police. We do have new technology, but you still have to use it and get out there and actually do it. 80% of U.S. seafood imports come from just 10 countries, China, Thailand, Indonesia, Ecuador, Canada, Vietnam, the Philippines, India, Mexico, Chile. You see how many of those border the Pacific Ocean. You've got countries with very high rates of illegal or unreported fishing, China, Vietnam, Indonesia. We've already cut something like two-thirds of the biomass out of the coastal regions of the world compared to pristine conditions. How are we going to keep pirate ships out of this part of the sea? How will we really do it and make sure it's not a paper park, Benjamin?
It's a great question, and it is a big challenge, but I think there's a lot of opportunity and optimism for technological solutions to this. Sylvia mentioned that, and actually at this conference, the Navy, U.S. Navy, talked about a collaboration they're engaging in with Palau to develop sea land and drone-based surveillance of the entire waters of that country as sort of a pilot study in collaboration with them. And I think there is a lot of emerging technologies that are changing the way that we can understand and monitor and enforce, you know, vast areas of our planet. So it's challenging now, but I think it's going to get easier and easier as we move forward. And you can, you know, with the initiatives to try to end pirate fishing across the planet, if those take effect and are effective, then if you don't know where the fish came from legally, you can't land it, you can't sell it. And so you might have people trying to fish out there, but they're not going to be able to bring it into port anywhere. So these combined efforts of greater surveillance and greater enforcement on land of where the fish are coming from, I think will make a big difference. And as Sylvia said, we have to start now. We can't wait until the problem gets so dire that any action is too late. And I think it's really important that we are taking these actions now.
I should say we've got a map up now at our website, onpointradio.org, of the general outline of this, what's anticipated here with this very large sanctuary in the Pacific. Sylvia Earle points to Teddy Roosevelt taking big chunks of the West sort of out of reach before operations really got revved up there. What about pressures in the future? President Obama says no mining, no deep-sea mining here. But 50 years from now, who knows, Benjamin? Are we going to see all kinds of pressure to get in there for whatever's underneath these seas?
I think so. I mean, the Pacific has some really rich, valuable deposits of manganese and other precious metals that are on the seabed, and there's a lot of companies eyeing those. And I think we don't know where they all are because it's really hard to do exploration in these deep areas, but we're going to improve technologies there for finding stuff as well. So setting aside these areas before that pressure gets too intense, just as Roosevelt did in the West, I think it's a really bold move, and it will help ensure that some part of the ocean is left alone so that we can have it as a reference point, a sort of a cultural icon of what the planet can be if we leave it alone.
Check out the full expanse of what's anticipated at our website, onpointradio.org. You can see the atolls and islands around which President Obama would like to see this very large monument or sanctuary come into effect. Benjamin Halpern at UC Santa Barbara, the School of Environmental Science and Management there, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
And National Geographic Explorer in Residence, founder of Mission Blue, Sylvia Earle. Always great to have you. Thank you, Sylvia. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.